The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra midweek Premier League special. Wolves shocked Chelsea, Watford almost shocked City, and Burnley shocked Liverpool for a short time. Lots of fun, lots of mistakes, and ironic hair pulling at Old Trafford as United and Arsenal draw 2-2. Elsewhere, we'll discuss classic footballer headbutts, dirty kitchens, and a great opportunity to mention Paolo Wanchope. That plus Kilmarnock for the Scottish Premiership. We'll ask if replacing this panel of respected journalists with a selection of superstar DJs would be a good way of killing this pod forever. And we'll answer your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Amy Lawrence, nice to see you.
Good morning, Max.
Are you well?
I'm really fine and dandy, and I'm sure you're feeling fab.
Yeah, I always feel fab. Is there any reason why you're suggesting?
Well, you've had a good week, haven't you?
We have had a good week, yeah. Mike Calvin, how are you?
I'm very well, actually, given the circumstances.
Yeah. Well, what, of just being here?
Yeah, being in the enemy territory.
Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
This is a question from Paul Scholes, is my hero. As you alluded to, Amy, we won the Football Supporters Federation podcast of the year. I wasn't going to bring it up, but you did. And he says, with 5 of 6 titles, is this podcast league just a glorified Ligue 1, Barry?
I don't know. It was very nice to win again. The Anfield Rap were the one who took one away from us, and we beat Mike Calvin's BT Sport lot this year, among others. So it was a very high quality opposition, and a pleasure to win. Thank you to everyone who voted.
I'm shedding a silent tear, listeners, and I have to say I've already got Der Spiegel on the case. I've been hearing some horrible rumours about vote fixing, so the second point is I'm going to basically undermine from within.
That's a good idea. Lots of people asking if you thanked me this time. Because last year you forgot to thank me because I wasn't there. I was there, so I was it would be harder for you not to.
Well, I didn't thank you, but I did. Jimbo obviously came straight to me to, because I'm the most important person here. And I told him he should speak to you because I had forgotten to thank you last year.
Yeah. So. Anyway, it was a lovely time. Thanks for voting for us. And thanks also for coming to our live show last Thursday. That was also fun. We've got another one in Dublin in January. 22nd, is it? So, yes, if you're in or around the Dublin area, come along. Right, Premier League. This is the first Premier League match day in which all 20 teams have scored a goal since 2010. That's exciting, isn't it? Should we start at Old Trafford, Amy? What a fun game that was.
Well, it's funny you should mention all these goals going in because, you know, generally when these things happen, it's either because the quality of strikers on show is extraordinary or because the lack of quality in defending is very obvious. And it was a really strange one, and I think that really four crap goals in that
game. It was very League One.
You know, you see that Twitter feed, you know, with crap 90s football or whatever it is, where they find sort of a 1 minute and 12 seconds of absolute glorious awfulness from some match, you know, back in the day. And, you know, there was definitely a moment in that game where the sort of Rojo kicks Lacazette, who ends up with Bailey on his head, and the ball rolls past De Gea, and 13 seconds later Kolasinac has a, you know, total lapse of reason, and Bernd Leno's looking at him like, what are you doing to me? And suddenly the ball's in the back of the net, and you think that was crap football. But obviously it's the joy of the Premier League, isn't it? I mean, I did watch it thinking Manchester United are such an odd beast at the moment, and that out of sortsness within them seems to be something unfixable right now, and Arsenal on a better day probably ought to have capitalised on that. They've gone up to this particular fixture in the last few years and underwhelmed spectacularly, frozen a lot, and this was another good opportunity, I think, to try and take the 3 points. And perhaps if they hadn't expended quite as much energy as they did in the North London derby, which I think told a bit, the two first half injuries, having to make changes, having to not be able to strategically make the changes that were perhaps so effective in Arsenal beating Tottenham on the weekend. Just thought I'd throw that in there. I think it meant that Arsenal didn't quite have enough precision maybe or in their play to make it count at the end. When you look at the lineup of Man United, and Mourinho's doing his intriguing things at the moment. There's arguably some reason to the bench that he chose rather than starting with some of those guys, because I think maybe he did that out of a sense that Arsenal do come on strong late in games at the moment.
And Barry, you tweeted,
bringing those players on, I think, sort of definitely asked different questions towards the end of the game.
But you tweeted that starting lineup of Jose and said, "What, please fire me," or something to that effect.
Yeah, it was quite odd that he left Paul Pogba and Romelu Lukaku on the bench. That's a lot of expensive talent to leave kicking their heels. And also in his programme notes, he said quite pointedly, there isn't space for people who are not ready to give their all. And that was, I would suggest, definitely a message aimed at Paul Pogba and possibly the pair of them. I really enjoyed the game. It was chaotic, and I think Arsenal probably should have won it, but it was hard for them to match the intensity. It was a bit after the Lord Mayor's show. One thing I'm curious about is the goal Lacazette scored, where he did the reenactment of Gary Crosby for Nottingham Forest against Andy Dibble. Should that have stood? I think so.
Yeah, instinctively, anyone of our age straight away went, "Oh, Gary Crosby," because it was an almost identical replica. And I did see some, I think there's been some changes to the laws of the game in the goalkeeper's favour in those circumstances. And it does seem to say that even if the goalkeeper has one outstretched hand on the ball, that that's enough for it to be in his control, which probably wasn't the case way back in
I think morally, you look at that morally. And also it would have been incomplete sort of empathy with the entire game, which was basically, "I'm a defender, get me out of here." And if you look at the way, you know, Manchester United, or that the whole thing was mad, because, you know, Rocco had the most shots on target last night.
Yeah.
And some of them were even on Arsenal's goal. It was amazing. You know, there was a almost, if you look at the stats, I think it was 15 of the players, their pass percentage was less than 80%. So they're not doing their job very well. And
can you not credit the, because there was, they both sides pressed quite well. I wonder if they, can you credit the opposition?
There is that part of it. But I'm just looking at basic, you look at basic percentages, and you're going to be over sort of around about that 90% mark, really, if you're worth your salt at that level. You know, the whole United thing is more surreal by the week, I think. I think Sky should, are missing a trick a bit. I think they should get Peter Jackson from The Lord of the Rings out on there. And the Man United team announcements should be set to that. You know that clip in the film where the orcs are coming out of the primordial slime? That team, that would be a perfect team announcement for Man United at the moment. Because you look at that team last night. I think it was Dave Priest said on Twitter, you know, that was him in the middle of the high street, shirt off, "Come on, and who's having it?" You know, it was basically a team that was going to confront, you know, whatever people wanted to confront him with, really. I felt, you know, that there's a tiredness about the whole Mourinho sideshow at the moment. And again, if you look at the stats, you know, he's whinging about money. I thought the thing last night, Manchester United's bench was nearly £245 million worth of footballers. The entire Arsenal squad was worth, or they paid, £232 million for. So he's whinging around about having no money and, you know, not having the right players. Get out on the training pitch and do your job.
Having said that, I did see from United, as I said, they pressed. They seem to play with much more energy and desire than in the Southampton game, especially in the Palace game.
Better. Yeah, but they're intense for a while, and then they kind of can't be dealing with this anymore, and they do it in, you know, sort of waves. It's not, there's no consistency about them. And you know, the whinge about investment is ridiculous, because he has been giving him money to invest, and the players he invests in are either square pegs in round holes or they regress under him.
Well, where's Fred? You know, they've signed a midfielder, presumably of his choosing, for quite a lot of money last summer.
Yeah, it wasn't on the bench even.
In the squad.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something fractured in terms of your idea and your plan and your strategy and the reality. There's something really big missing there. But the bare facts of it are just, how can you justify, a year ago, I think Man United were second in the table and not that many points off of the top, off of Man City. This season, they're 18 points behind. They're in eighth place. They've got a negative goal difference. They're behind, not only are they behind Man City, they're behind a whole host of teams, including, you know, Everton, Bournemouth, Arsenal, which are the sort of teams they won't be comfortable being behind compared to last season. So it's just intriguing to see where they go from here. How long does this situation realistically sort of limp along?
Jose, after the game, it was fun. Jose said, "We made so many mistakes." And the reporter said, "How do you stop that?" And Jose said, "I can't answer you. I am Manchester United manager. I can't answer you," which was sort of amusingly cryptic. Jay says, "I'd like to hear Amy's view on Arsenal and where she thought we would be this time of year after the manager change."
I think they're probably quite ahead of most expectations. There was a lot that needed doing, and there still remains quite a lot to be doing. And I think when you look at where Arsenal are now and you compare to sort of, you know, take City out of the equation, really, but if you look at perhaps Liverpool, Chelsea and Tottenham as being the more realistic teams that they should be aiming to be competing properly with, and Man United, obviously, but they've got their issues at the moment. The other teams are 2, 3, 4 years into their projects, if you like, with them, their new managers or newish managers. It does take time. It takes time not just for a manager to put across their ideas, but also for there to be essentially enough windows to make the changes to the squad. And it's quite obvious that Emery has tried to imprint his ideas with what he has, but it's not perfect. They clearly need some new defenders who are a bit better at defending somewhere along the line, you know, as soon as possible. I don't think they're about to invest heavily. I don't think that's part of the model, but there are improvements to be made in that department. And, you know, it's clear there's some shenanigans regarding Mesut Ozil. The Aaron Ramsey situation is coming to a quite strange head. And these are players, and, you know, within the overall picture that, you know, that you're going to, ideally, if you're Unai Emery, bring in exactly who you want or more of the types of players you want. However, having said all that, I think for them to be putting in the kind of performances that they've shown they're able to do, and it's taken them a while to have sort of good 90 minutes. I mean, it's been really good 45 minutes for most of the season. But obviously against Tottenham, they managed to have that intensity that Emery's all about for a much longer period of time. And you can tell that there's something going on in energy within the squad. You can tell there's a unity there, that they're, in general, believing in something. And I think that what they're enjoying as a squad is really serious instruction. So they understand exactly what's required of them when they're out on the pitch. And B, they've got a kind of an engagement with what's going on again. The vibes are completely different within the team. And I think they feel that there's something happening there. And it's not going to be overnight, and there's a lot longer to go. And the idea that they might be trying to, you know, win the league or win the Premier League, Champions League, which is what the hierarchy are talking about going for one day, that's a way away. But to be trying to be second or third or trying to get back in the Champions League, there certainly should be closer to that this season, which is creditable.
Yeah, I think there's been a screeching U-turn in you know, more ways than one, in terms of, if you look at the Ozil situation, that package was sort of indicative of a strategy which says, right, let's get a marquee player. Let's have there's a marquee player we can use in our merchandising, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that patently hasn't worked. And we've got a sort of a mini Pogba situation happening there, where what is his worth to the brand? And what is his worth to the team? Well, at the moment, probably his worth to the brand is far more than the team, because the team, as you say, Amy, has got this collective will about it that it didn't have in the latter years of Arsene Wenger. You know, there's no more soft touch. You can see in the way that they're defending, albeit with inferior defenders, if you're talking about a top four, top six club, there is a consistency, a purpose, and an organisation about what they're doing. And when, you know, when you listen to Emery, and okay, the Peaky Blinders English is you know, not up to the job at the moment, but there is a degree of intensity about him which is reflected in the team, which is what a manager should do, and what patently Mourinho is failing to do. And I think that there is an irony that I think this Arsenal team have never been closer in spirit to the fans. And this comes at a time when the club itself is growing away from the fans with the whole, you know, Kroenke-esque gimme, gimme, gimme culture.
I think that's a really interesting point. And one of the things that has changed, I mean, obviously at the club, not only did Wenger leave over the summer, but there was a whole raft of people that left. Loads of members of staff, Ivan Gazidis. There's a whole host of new people that have either been promoted from within or coming from outside to be more involved in the whole running of the club. You've got Per Mertesacker involved in youth development. Sven Mislintat has come from Germany, who's a really interesting character, involved in the head of recruitment. And these are people who are very, very aware. And when you speak to them, it's obvious one of their priorities is how do we re-engage with the fan base? They know, they're not hiding their heads in the sand. They know that the fans were disaffected, not unified. There was factions all over the place. There was disagreements all over the place in recent years. Fans were, you know, evidently staying away, even though they bought tickets, which is a damning indictment for any football club last season. So one of the things that they are conscious of, and it's a difficult trick to pull off, is how do we re-inspire and re-engage with our fan base? Part of that's down to the players, and even little things like, is it enough at the end of the game to just kind of go over and kind of half clap and half wave and clear off? How can you feel, you know, make people feel more identified with what's going on, what you're trying to achieve? And even some of the body language in the game against Tottenham, I think, was important in that regard, because, you know, having a fight, you know, Stefan Lischteiner doing what he does to be
God,
one
he
of
does,
the world's most
he did it again
people.
In the last minute
exactly
yesterday.
I mean, it's kind of needed. Players showing a bit more spirit, trying to be more openly kind of into it all, is a subtle thing. Yeah. Lucas Torreira's influence as this kind of little bundle of high energy intensity. It's something that people are clinging to and saying, hey, I like this. I want to be part of this again. Yeah. And off the pitch, without trying to ram it down people's throat and be cheesy, they're trying gently in this sort of subtle way to say, come back on board. Let's be together here.
I'm conscious that we've got 19 other clubs to talk about on the pod. The most important part, Barry, was, I don't know if it's irony, whatever it was, but Fellaini pulling Guendouzi's hair made me so happy. I mean, it's obviously utter shithousery of the highest order, especially when you... Isn't that the reason why he shaved his hair off? I don't know, but it was just tremendous.
I knew you'd come to me after that with a yogurt pot for hats question, as you always do. Yeah, well, not so much yogurt pots for hats, but it was funny, yes. It was a dumb thing for him to do. He could have got sent off, but... Yeah,
but do you think he hasn't done that for so many years? Because
he's probably done it because it's been done to him so often, and now people can't do it. He's just going to cut loose.
I've got to tell you, I wouldn't expect you guys to be able to empathise, but it bloody hurts when someone pulls and yanks your hair. It's not that nice. But by the way,
who's yanking your hair,
Barry? Daniel Passarella, remember him?
Yeah.
Remember he was the coach of Argentina in 1998, and amongst his edicts, he banned long hair and banned earrings and various other things. You weren't allowed to be in that Argentina team. Claudio Caniggia had long hair, I remember, but Passarella wasn't having it. Absolutely disapproved, like, fundamentally.
Military haircuts. Well, maybe Guendouzi will learn, you know. That's the only way. Manchester United home to Fulham, Arsenal home to Huddersfield at the weekend. Wolves 2, Chelsea 1. This was an interesting game, Mike, because Chelsea could have been out of sight before Wolves came back. But by the end, Sarri's saying, I'm worried because Chelsea sort of couldn't get back into it.
Yeah, much more of this, and Sarri's going to be a walking nicotine patch during games, isn't he, really? It's just...
The David Squires picture of him is absolutely...
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's fantastic.
He's got...
I couldn't stop laughing at that. I didn't see it till this morning, and I was just laughing like a drain.
Brilliant. I don't know, that again, you know, the defending there was appalling. You know, they're playing Manchester City on Saturday. If they turn up like that, we're in think of a number and double it territory, probably. I thought Wolves were excellent. And I think, you know, the link to that Arsenal discussion that we had is that I think that club will go forward once they produce one of their own. And I think we saw that last night, the power of that, with the Premier League debut of Morgan Gibbs-White, where, you know, here's a young player in that successful England under-17 squad. Basically, he gets his chance, small, technically adept, strong, but has got lovely spatial awareness, and some of the passing that he was doing was excellent. And I thought there, Wolves is the type of club, despite all the sort of Mendes machinations in the background, is still a traditional football club, a blue-collar football club. And again, I sense very much, you know, watching that last night, the reaction and the response to him when he was substituted after about an hour was really intense. And interestingly, he was the last player to leave the pitch at the end of the game. As a substitute, he came on with the, you know, the normal shaking hands at the end and lingered, and the fans lingered with him to applaud him off, which I thought, yeah, okay, one of our own. And I don't think we really should underestimate the emotional pull of something like that.
Oh yeah, you know, when it's one of your youth team players, you love it, don't you? It was his first start, wasn't it? He's come off the bench. He played brilliantly actually in Arsenal when he came on. Look, Chelsea had 17 shots to 6, 70% of possession. Should Sarri be worried, Barry?
Not necessarily. I mean, it was a bad performance. That's two they've had in three games now. So that is grounds for concern. I think they're more than good enough to finish in the top four, and I don't think winning the title was ever a realistic proposition anyway. But he was clearly very angry last night, and, you know, that's, as I say, twice now in three games he's been very angry afterwards. And he is right to be concerned about their sort of lackadaisical attitude, and I think that's the only thing even remotely posing a threat to Manchester City. They're a bit too blasé at times, and that could cost them. But I would imagine in both cases, Sarri and Pep are more than capable of, you know, administering the necessary boots up the backside that to prevent that.
Was there a foul on Morata from Boney? When that, and they're very rarely given, aren't they? But it's 1-0, and if it is a foul, it's a red card, and it does change everything there, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, that did look a penalty, I thought. And again, I think perhaps Sarri's anger is less maybe about his team, because I think for certainly a good hour or so, they played pretty well. They had plenty of chances to double their lead. They definitely should have had that penalty. And then you're maybe looking at limiting the opportunity for Wolves to come back and win the game late on. It was just a really good Premier League game that could have gone in different directions. And I don't think Sarri should be particularly worried. Again, you know, this is a guy who's come to the club just in the summer, and he's had a fantastic immediate impact, a sort of honeymoon period. It's natural that you're maybe going to have a little moment where things back off a bit. And if you look at this league is... it's not an ordinary situation that you find yourself in if you're not Man City. You know, Man City are creating an extraordinary situation in the Premier League. So ordinarily, Chelsea are having a really good season. Tottenham are having a pretty decent season. Liverpool are having an outstanding season, and yet still, they can't knock Man City off the top. You have this difficult feeling that as well as you're doing, there's a heck of a barrier in front of you that looks, if not insurmountable, incredibly difficult to keep up with. So I think it's difficult to judge and say, oh, Chelsea are, you know, falling off a bit of a wobble. But a couple of bad games over the course of a season, a little bit of a lull. You know, the winter period is going to be an interesting one, because for managers, particularly like Sarri and Emery, who are new to the league, It's a first time you're dealing with a huge kind of winter slog.
I mean, we want Chelsea to beat City, don't we, as a neutral at the weekend, Mike?
It's sort of City are almost too beautiful to be good, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think the problem with Chelsea at the moment is that, you know, there are understandable and probably predictable warning signs there. One, you can't see Morata ever convincing as a Premier League striker, so they've got to probably address that in January. Is there the will from Abramovich downwards to do so? But secondly, we're in now that sort of, you know, the courtship rituals with Eden Hazard and Real Madrid seem to be intensifying. They've gone from sort of winking suggestively at him to having a quick snog in the corner now. It seems that, you know, we're moving towards some sort of break between Chelsea and Eden Hazard, I would think. You know, it's an interesting one because he's never seemed to be overtly ambitious in the way that other footballers are. But I just think there is just a momentum quietly building behind the fact that I don't think he'll be at Chelsea next season.
I'm wary of doing a yoga pass for hats question.
I was just going to say,
it's not even a question, but Wolves substitute Leander Dendonca. I was just thinking, did we ever think there'd be a time where there'd be a footballer who's named rhymed with Clive Mendonca, and that, you know, Dendonca and Mendonca could be the next Hoddle and Waddle and go on a pop career? It's not even a question, Barry. It's just something I noticed. You, Chelsea play City on Saturday, Wolves go to Newcastle on Sunday. You can lead the Watford-Manchester City conversation then, Barry. I thought, you know, Watford did scare City, didn't they? Did they? I think they did. You were there, Amy. You can't lead this, Amy. You were there. I'll be back in a minute, Barry.
I wouldn't imagine. You know, it was more someone walks into the room when you've headphones on and startles you rather than, you know, cowering in a wardrobe terrified while a man in a hockey mask with a big knife sort of prowls around your house scary. But
okay, that's how you define scare. You were there, Amy.
I was there, and I'm just trying to digest those analogies. a bit scared myself. What was the best part of it, without any doubt, was Edison at one point. They conceded this goal. I mean, Man City were so comfortable, it was absurd. And you were just sitting there sort of admiring, trying to come up with the new words for describing this level of dominance that they have, because dominance didn't seem to be enough somehow. And suddenly, Watford snaffle a goal. And it just, the atmosphere changed in a heartbeat. And there was that kind of guttural roar every time Watford fed, piled everybody forward. And Man City's defenders did look anxious and a little bit nervy and under pressure. And then Edison, the ball comes back to Edison, and he juggles the ball before booting it out. Like, a bit of keepy-uppy there. And it was just extraordinary, because if anybody else in Man City's back line, and they did look like they were feeling the pressure, showed it, he certainly didn't, which I think in itself tells you something.
He was really cool in the first half, I thought. You know, their dominance was such that he was basically in danger of getting frostbite. You know, it was, everything was at the other end. Then Watford broke away and he had to make a really smart save to keep it at 0-0. And I thought, well, one, there's the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper's union will purr at that, because here's someone who's had nothing to do but maybe to count the spectators for half an hour. And in that split second when he's required, he does it. And he has, you know, does his job brilliantly.
In one way, actually, though, this sudden flurry of 5-minute pressure that they had is possibly the worst thing that could happen to everybody.
Yeah, without losing points, yeah.
Because Guardiola came in afterwards and somebody said to him, you know, like, oh, you know, what were you a bit concerned by the last few minutes? And he was like, look, we've just been talking about that in the locker room, you know. Hmm. Like, straight away you could tell he would have gone in. They've won, they've got 3 points, they're miles away, doing incredibly at the top of the league. And he's given them a bollocking. And the reason he's been able to do so is because they took their eye off the ball, so to speak, and were maybe a touch complacent. They had plenty of chances to score a third goal. Gabriel Jesus sort of stood out a bit, because he looks like the one player in the Man City team at the moment who is somehow struggling for confidence. And he just couldn't buy a goal. He had a few good chances, and Mahrez has come in and he looks so comfortable in the team, and they're managing to make 6 changes and the whole back four gets changed, and you know, they're winning comfortably, and Aguero's not there and De Bruyne is still not around. You think, God, look at this team, it's just
must be really sad for him, mustn't it, given how good everyone else is.
But anyway, he had these chances which were not taken to make it very comfortable. Yeah. And then all of a sudden they've got pressure. And Guardiola's point was, okay, we learn from this. Like, do not mess about. You know, if you don't concentrate for 90 minutes, if you think you're comfortable in a Premier League game, and we're entitled to feel that way because we normally are, come on. And it was a bit of a salutary reminder, which just ahead of going to Stamford Bridge is probably the worst thing for those neutrals you're talking about, Max, who want a Chelsea victory.
That's where we've got to, is that Pep is basically having to accentuate the negative. The previous game against Bournemouth, you know, they were pretty average for about 25 minutes. And he dwelt upon that afterwards rather than, you know, the mesmeric stuff around it. So you've got a manager strangely in a position of rather than just pulling out everything that's positive about their performances, he's looking for those little flaws. And, you know, as you say, Amy, it's pretty bad news because, you know, 4 points dropped so far. You look at it now and it's almost relentless. The excellence is relentless.
Barry, do you think Invincibles? Yeah.
No. I think someone will beat them, but it's difficult to know how, you know, we're basically down, insofar as you could label it a two-horse race. It is still technically a two-horse race, but the pressure on Liverpool just to keep winning game after game after game, just to stay in touch, I think they will crack under that pressure sooner rather than later. But, like I say, complacency is City's worst enemy, but Pep is very wary of that.
Right, and that's where we'll start part two at Burnley, Liverpool's 3-1 win there. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Turf Moor, Barry. Burnley 1, Liverpool 3. When do we start taking them seriously, Liverpool? Because we keep saying City are going to win by 10 points. Liverpool, as we said just at the end of part one, you know, they do keep on winning. And this was a game where they were under pressure. They didn't have Firmino, Mane and Salah starting. And yet they still got the points.
Yeah, the scoreline would suggest Liverpool had it quite easy and they didn't. It was probably one of Burnley's better performances this season, and Jurgen Klopp made a lot of changes, was it 6-7 changes, and left out some big names, which was a bit of a gamble and could have backfired but didn't. But I thought it was a decent game by the looks of it. You know, I've only seen Match of the Day highlights, but I can't take Liverpool seriously as title contenders. I just, not because I dislike them or for any particular, I just think Manchester City are vastly superior and will pull away. I think there is just an inevitability about it. But I suppose until this happens, it's just speculation on my part, isn't it? But the stats suggest that in every department, Manchester City are just ridiculously superior to Liverpool.
For balance, because some Liverpool fans will be angry if we don't say they could win the title, does one of you want to make a case?
Well, at the start of the season, I said that they would. And I still think they've got half a chance. I don't think it's as cut and dried as Barry would say. And by the way, I think we probably need a moment's silence for his Twitter feed after that comment. But I, you know, if you look at last night, it was significant in several ways. One, it could have been last night, the night that Manchester City won the title, if Burnley had won that. Mm-hmm. You can't see them making up 5 points. They're still 2 points behind. He made those seven changes that Barry spoke about, and I suppose rotation is in the Premier League, it's sort of managerial equivalent of firewalking, isn't it? You basically get across and do it as quickly as you can and hope there's not much damage on the route. The team has got depth. You know, you only look at the identity of the scorer of the winning goal in the derby, Origi, who'd been nowhere playing for the under-23s. So there is depth there. Will they hang on to City's coattails? Possibly not, but City might get distracted by the Champions League. I still think strategically the Champions League is more important to City than the Premier League. And frankly, we need them to hang on to the coattails. Otherwise, you know, we're going to get into a Ligue 1 situation, aren't we?
Jurgen Klopp was very critical of Burnley's tackling, Amy. He said, "We won the game, but the challenges from the beginning, the sliding tackling on that wet ground. The referee should have said something earlier. The injury threat is massive." She's saying, well, you get the ball, which is nice, but it's like ten-pin bowling because you get the player as well. I think he's referring, you know, Joe Gomez got injured. And it didn't look like a
particular... tackle in which Joe Gomez got injured was one of the best tackles I've seen in a long time. It was a brilliant tackle.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
If Jurgen Klopp has a problem with that, well, he's wrong, because it's unfortunate that Joe Gomez got injured. I hope it's nothing too serious, but by the looks of things, it might be. But it was an accident, and there was nothing wrong with the tackle. It was perfect.
Only thing I would say just overall about Liverpool is that, you know, as we've all been saying, that if it wasn't for this City team being the way that they are, that, you know, that wave of enthusiasm would be even greater, I think, at Anfield for what they're doing. And I do admire the way that even if, a game like last night, they're having a bit of a tough time. They have got solutions, and they've got a belief in those solutions. It was a brilliantly taken goal from James Milner to get them back into it. And then the way Van Dijk puts it across was absolutely superb for Firmino. And they've still got that creativity in the attack, and the way that they kind of come in waves and in a pack that can overwhelm, you know, pretty much any opponent. And on top of that, the way that they've improved evidently on last year is at the back. I mean, they just... Van Dijk is having a remarkably good season, and Alisson, who pulled off a couple of very important saves and instigated the move for one of the breakaway goals, is a really important and influential part. And when you talk about the seven changes, I don't think it's a coincidence that the people that you don't change are your really, really good goalkeeper and your really, really good centre-half.
Liverpool go to Bournemouth on Saturday. Burnley, who are now 19th, host Brighton. Brighton beat Palace 3-1 in that derby game. Terrible decision by Kevin Friend for the first penalty. Glenn Murray scored it off the bar. McCarthy actually got fouled by Izquierdo for that. Then, probably my favourite minute of certainly the 2 days' games. So Glenn Murray possibly gets fouled by James Tompkins, maybe not, but the ball goes out and it's definitely not a corner. The ref gives a corner. There's a melee for some reason. Shane Duffy does a footballer headbutt, i.e. you connect with the head first and then you push like a rutting stag on Van Aanholt. And he really has to duck to do that because he's two heads taller than Van Aanholt. Glenn Murray doesn't see that because he's injured. So then he's told that Duffy's been sent off and he's just does this sort of head roll. Brighton are forced into a tactical change, taking off Gross, bringing on Balogun from the corner, which shouldn't have been a corner. He scores with his first touch and his first goal for Brighton. That's what football's about for me, Mike.
It's the chaos theory in action, isn't it, really? It's a straight... I can't get my head around that being classified as a white-hot derby. You know, it's sort of suburban squabble more than anything else, isn't it?
Wow. Hey, look at your Twitter feed.
Twitter feed alert.
Well, it all started over a spilt cup of, or a hurled cup of coffee, didn't it? Many, many years ago. Yeah, Ron Atkinson and Rodney Marsh, was it?
I feel Malcolm Allison was involved, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good story worth digging out on the Guardian website, but it's a really weird rivalry that started over two former Tottenham teammates managing different clubs, and
it's almost as weird as having to apply for the Crystal Palace singing section, isn't it? Where are we going with that?
Are they having auditions? Is it like an X Factor type?
Yeah, reach for the stars.
I mean, I think Steve Parrish would look quite good on a panel of, the cowl role.
What, sort of white shirt slashed to the navel.
Like. And then Mark Bright would be the sort of nice judge, wouldn't he? I don't know if we can fill it out with two others.
And then
Roy Hodgson would be the grump in the corner.
He's playing the Louis Walsh sort of, I'm not really sure what's going on type thing.
And the Crystals could, you know, do entertainment at either end of the show. And Kayla the Eagle could soar down from the rafters and land on the winner's head.
We've got to pitch this to Quest TV before anyone else does. It was Terry Venables and Alan Mullery.
Ah, correct.
Before anyone tells us off. Are we worried about Palace at all, Amy? They're 15th now. They're 3 points off the relegation. So they won at the weekend, their first home win of the season. But they're, you know, it's tight down there, isn't it?
It is tight down there. I mean, I don't think at this stage anybody around that last handful of places is going to be feeling too comfortable, and justifiably so. I don't think there's anybody you'd even condemn just yet. So it just goes to show that there's three spots you don't want to be in. And right now, Crystal Palace are 3 points ahead of that zone, so I don't think they can be in any way relaxed about their situation. But you would imagine that they'd probably have enough experience of what to do, and a manager who knows what to do to sort it out over the remaining months.
I suppose the problem is who's going to score the goals, and it's a problem that's also common to Huddersfield and to Cardiff. That you look at that team without Zaha, that team really doesn't have a focal point in an attacking sense. You know, you've got Benteke, who's been basically has disappeared off the planet. Obviously, he's been injured as well. But even when he's on the pitch, he just looked like a confidence-free zone. And Wickham is coming through as well, isn't he? He's been injured for, what, 18 months probably?
Yeah.
So I'm struggling to look at, you know, who will score their goals for them.
If they can get Wickham fit, he's far from a world beater, but he's a striker who tends, if he gets one, he'll get, you know, five or six in consecutive games. He's very much a foreign player. He's like sort of single-handedly kept Sunderland up one season just by doing that. But can they get him fit? I think he's played a few reserves games and had setbacks and, yeah.
Producer Jonathan points out that they were pretty unlucky in this game. I mean, the first two goals shouldn't have happened. They had 16 shots after the red card to Brighton 6. In other Crystal Palace news, they've taken action to remedy the issues highlighted after the kitchen at the club's training ground was given a zero food hygiene rating because inspectors have found it been infested with mice for several months. They found a, quote, significant mouse problem at the Beckenham training ground. And that looks after the players and the stars. That had to be shut down. You have been given a food hygiene rating of naught, read the report. You wonder if, you know, the kitchen, the same way that apparently Martin Keown got very angry and he saw he'd only got 5 out of 10 in the papers, that, you know, the kitchen, when they looked in the paper for their hygiene rating over the weekend and it was a naught, they were very unhappy. They go to West Ham on
So they need
Saturday.
To get themselves a cat or
yeah,
two.
Absolutely,
or
good idea.
Or a sponsorship deal with Rent-A-Kill.
Yeah. She's always thinking about the brand, aren't you? That's why the game's gone, Mike. I thought you cared about, you know, the grassroots of just getting a little moggy there. Tottenham 3, Southampton 1. Pretty regulation win this for Tottenham, Mike. Pochettino said Hugo Lloris was the man of the match, which was interesting. I mean, he made one ridiculous save from Højbjerg at 1-0, didn't he? And then a few more saves when it was 3-0 and Tottenham presumably were just wandering about.
They were wandering about and no one seemed too bothered to even watch them. You know, was it 33,000 yeah. at Wembley? There's more atmosphere in deep space, wasn't there? And I'm, you know, the whole Wembley thing is gradually sort of winding down to sort of mutual boredom. And it just emphasises to me what a terrible place to watch football Wembley is. You know, you pay 40 or 50 quid to park your car. It's, you know,
to park your car.
Yeah. No one drives to Wembley.
Well, that's the. I think it's anywhere between £30 and £50 for a game. A Champions League game is £50 to park. I'm told.
That's ridiculous. What they really need is they need some sort of entertainment for the queue for the tube, because you're sort of you know they stop it at stages. So when you're walking out, there's just a real frustration. Obviously, it's sensible and it avoids crushing, but you are stood there going, God, you know, when you're not moving, very frustrating.
Maybe the Crystal Palace X Factor style thing you were talking about.
Projected on a big screen.
But it's about, no, you know, customer experience and all that sort of, you know, nonsense and that jargon-esque.
That's the gruesome reality of modern football. And what I would say, I suppose, is that you've got to credit the team for actually, they're on a run of, what, 6 wins in 7 or something like that. You can imagine it would be easy with the difficulties of that. The atmosphere has really dropped off badly. That engagement we talked about before is suffering, and yet obviously they're still, you know, playing really pretty well. But I mean, they need to get out of it there as quickly as possible. But they still haven't even got a date.
No, but what they have done is they're now organising fan tours around the new stadium. So it's, you know, a building site. Oh, you can't watch football there, even though you might have paid for your season tickets, but you can come and pay to go on the official tour of the new stadium.
And the club shop is open apparently as well.
Absolutely. Mm. So, you know, Daniel Levy's in this sort of Sun King stage, isn't he? You know, he would have someone alongside him advising fans to eat cakes. You know, it's just crap.
Yeah, but the problem is that if they were in a position where it was unlikely to be, you know, what they were hoping for at the beginning of the season, okay, so you maybe could have got away with skipping that first 2, 3, 4 games or what have you. But once that's... I'm sure they must have known the likelihood that it was going to roll on and on this season, in which case they should have just done the decent thing, which is saying, okay, we're another year here, and then we move back properly. Because it's created this kind of limbo, really. I can understand why, from the fans' point of view, they were all expecting, they had their new season tickets, you know, they've probably all gone and got a virtual kind of idea of exactly where their seat is, what it's going to look like. Everything's ready to go. They've even got, you know, got season tickets ready to go. And then it's not happening again, and you've got to sort of reapply to go to matches at Wembley. And
there's just been zero.
It's not been remotely fair on the Tottenham fans who are.
There's been
stuck
zero
in
transparency, isn't there, about the whole thing.
Southampton, on the other hand, look, they hit the woodwork three times, had 18 shots, but without a win in 11. The next four games: Cardiff away, Arsenal at home, Huddersfield away, West Ham at home. Ralph Hasenhüttl. Which is a glorious name. Vachter on the asks, who can say Ralph Hasenhüttl, Ralph Hasenhüttl, Ralph Hasenhüttl the fastest? the Klopp of the Alps, apparently. He was in the stands. He has a big job on his hands, doesn't he?
Huge. And, you know, you talk to people around the game, scouts in particular, and they say that the whole structure there has almost dissolved over the last 18 months or so. The academy is not producing at the sort of level that they were expected. Their recruitment, which has been a strength in the past, has not been good over the last season and a half, couple of years. It's an interesting one because I thought they were quite fortunate to survive last season. They seem to have sleptwalked into trouble then. There's a bit of a softness about them. Now, obviously, our friend Mr. Hasenhüttl will... have that sort of, you know, the new man bounce, one assumes. He's in for a bit of a culture shock on Saturday. It's a real welcome to English football, isn't it, at Cardiff, with the buzz bombs coming over. So it'll be an interesting one, but I think they're in more trouble than perhaps they acknowledge.
Well, it's funny because in the past 10 years, Swansea, West Brom, Stoke and Southampton have all been held up as this is how a club should be run. Swansea, West Brom and Stoke were all relegated, and Southampton last season, very only reason they weren't relegated was because only three clubs go down. They were pretty rubbish. You know, I think Mark Hughes got far more credit than he deserved for keeping them up. You know, I think it was more the uselessness of other teams that kept them up than anything they did themselves. But yeah, it's weird how, you know, clubs can go from, you know, an example of how a football club should run to a complete basket case in such a short space of time.
Spurs go to Leicester. Barry, unfortunately for you, it's the late Saturday evening kickoff. So, you know, too late for the session drinkers. It's a 7:45 p.m. kickoff.
Right.
So you won't be following it.
I probably will.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but I do a radio show on Sunday mornings, which tends to preclude me from... going out in the last Saturday night.
I remember you saying a late Saturday kickoff is too late because if you watch the early kickoff, if you go to the pub to watch the early kickoff and then the late kickoff, by the 8 p.m. kickoff, well, you've just got no chance, have you? Southampton, as we've said, go to Cardiff, who lost 3-1 at West Ham. Two wins on the bounce for West Ham in the league for the first time since January last year. And two for Lucas Perez, the first West Ham substitute to score twice since Paolo Wanchope in the year 2000. Him even playing for West Ham had completely skipped my mind. He's still in a Derby County kit for me. Did he play for Derby?
It's Arsenal, wasn't it?
Wanchope. Wanchope was very much Derby.
Yeah. Very Derby
and
City. Yeah. Look, Cardiff, you can't miss a penalty at 0-0 if you're in that position, can you? Especially if there's a little fight over who should take it, Amy.
Yeah, that didn't seem like the best plan. They always say that there's supposed to be an order, isn't there? But then I guess if you're in the middle of a game and someone either fancies it or doesn't, was it worth the discussion?
Well, I think Warnock said afterwards that Joe Rawls was supposed to take it, but he won't be taking the next one.
Yeah. But like, it's a good win for West Ham. Bournemouth 2, Huddersfield 1. They've had a pretty tough fixture list, Bournemouth, you know, losing to Manchester United, they lost to Newcastle, Arsenal and Man City. So good for them to have on paper an easy game against Huddersfield, but
they haven't got a great one next, have they? Liverpool?
They got Liverpool next. Yeah. I think there's a nice feeling about Bournemouth Liverpool though, because they both play nice football. Be nice to see, Barry, if the pound shop Firmino, Mane and Salah go up against...
Yeah, well, no, I'm really looking forward to this game. And if it's Saturday lunchtime, if I'm not mistaken, they served up an absolute thriller on a Saturday lunchtime. Was it last season or the season before, a 4-3?
Bournemouth had 6 shots compared to Huddersfield's 23. So what does that mean? Now, we discovered last week that Huddersfield were good after we all thought they were terrible after their win against the Wolves.
Well, they possibly reverted to type. I actually, you know, as a neutral, you look at Huddersfield, especially David Wagner, and you know, we go back to the Southampton's decision. That basically tells us that there is a, you know, at the moment in vogue are coaches with German experience. You know, Hasenhüttl did well in the lower leagues. Daniel Farke's doing brilliantly at Norwich, and I thought Wagner did miracles last season to keep them up. And there is something engaging about him and his team, and you know, people like Pritchard. I find a really you know, just a nice player to watch. But you look at them, you think you're doomed. You know, it's
goal scorer again, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. Yeah, it is that. You know, Steve Mounier would, he's wandering around in the sort of a, you know, with a permanent shrugged shoulders. And also, when he does get the chance, he lacks the confidence, actually, to take it.
Mm. The race for sixth place, though, is interesting. Bournemouth level on points with Manchester United and Everton. And just, who have we got? Brighton, Leicester a point behind. Brighton a point behind them. Watford a point behind them. Wolves a point behind them. And West Ham a point behind them. The race for sixth could be the most exciting part of this season. Everton.
Good Lord, has it come to that?
Everton drew with Newcastle. It was a good finish from Solomon Rondon. Richarlison with the equaliser. Former Chelsea and Manchester United chief executive Peter Kenyon, heading a consortium that's in talks to buy Newcastle. Ben says, is Mike Ashley the best owner ever at winding up the supporters of his club? I know I should know better, but I'm sure this time he's telling the truth, Baz.
Yeah, he probably is. I mean, until a deal is done, if I was a Newcastle fan, I'd take every rumour about consortiums possibly buying the club with a huge skip full of salt.
Mm, he says these discussions are, quote, at a more progressed stage than they ever have been.
Well, I don't know how progressed previous ones have been. So that the Amanda Staveley one seemed to kind of fizzle out into nothing. And I really just don't know.
Kenyon is apparently working with the American financial advisory firm Rockefeller Capital Management, my favourite capital management firm, as it goes. Fulham 1, Leicester 1. Fulham could have been more than one up when Leicester equalised through the new Glenn Hoddle. James Maddison with a nice side foot finish. Chances for both to win it, but a game that I don't believe anyone will discuss in 10 years' time. Fitbar, Barry.
Mm. Hello.
Yeah, Kilmarnock, they're going to win the league.
They might win the league, and hats off to Steve Clark, who's quietly done a brilliant job at Kilmarnock. They were in all sorts of bother when he took over, and now they're top of the league. And they go to Parkhead at the weekend to play Celtic, and there's every chance they might possibly beat them. They clearly have a very good manager. I know Ewan Murray, our official football correspondent, has been very complimentary and fulsome in his praise of Clark's work, and it's hard to get Ewan enthusiastic about anything, really. So it's generally a really good sign. In other football news, Rangers lost against Aberdeen, and Alfredo Morelos was sent off.
No, he wasn't.
For the third time this season in the league. And that is 8 dismissals in all for Rangers this season. Not a dirty team, insists Steven Gerrard. But he was furious after the game with his own players for just... He said he'd given them like a 15-minute lecture yesterday about discipline and sticking to the game plan and not losing heads. And Morales, who's a notorious hothead, duly went and got his third red card of the season. I don't know what that means as far as suspension is concerned. It was for 2 yellows, but it's a problem for Rangers because he's their main source of goals as well, and by far their best player, but his temperament is very below par. Celtic, meanwhile, drew with Motherwell. So they're third place. Lee Griffiths missed a penalty, and Celtic were a goal up, and Motherwell scored a late equaliser. Hearts drew 2-2 with St Mirren. Adam Hamill scored the goal of that game, chipping Adam Bogdan from just inside his own half to score a wonder goal. And Kenny Miller aged 57, scored a hat-trick as a bottom side Dundee thrashed Hamilton 4-0.
Reading have sacked Paul Clement. He kept them up at the end of last season, but it's not been that great in the Championship this year. And Mike, I wonder if, you know, how many more... He's a lovely bloke, Paul Clement.
Yeah.
And obviously worked with some brilliant people. And I wonder, do you at some point go, actually, that's what I'm good at?
And I think there's an element of that. I did a long piece with him for, and here comes a plug, by the way, my recent book, State of Play. Mm. And
it's an excellent book.
Thank you very much. Mm. And I liked him as a person. I think he's an engaging, intelligent guy, thinks deeply about the game. He's one of these managers who has got a library full of NFL coaches and big on motivation and everything else. As a coach, he still has something, because when you look at the clubs that he's worked with and therefore the players that he's worked with, he has something about him and he has credibility. So much in management is about choosing the right club at the right time with the right people in charge of that football club. And I get the sense that Reading is adrift as a football club. You have two Thai owners have been, there were originally three. One's gone to Oxford to take over there while keeping his investment options open, which is land around the Majesty Stadium. You look around, you listen to the recruitment circuit, and they're saying there's no money there. So basically, they just threw it at Paul and said, "Right, get on with it. Coach this lot if you can." Mm. And at the Championship level, it's a very, very demanding and difficult league. And to be honest, I'm not that surprised that they've struggled. You're probably right. It was interesting. I was speaking to a chairman who was talking about Paul Clement in terms of recruitment. Would I recruit him as my manager? And that was the one thing he said about him. He said the one thing he's never proved beyond doubt that he's a number one rather than number two.
In the EFL Trophy, depressing scenes at Port Vale. Police arrested seven and condemned, quote, despicable behaviour by a large number of fans. Port Vale beat Stoke under-21s 4-0. It's the first time they've played each other since February 2002. Almost 4,000 Stoke fans went along, so in a crowd of just under 8,000. There were more than 150 police officers deployed. I don't know if any of you have seen the video of the away end toilets that are completely smashed in. Considerable damage was caused to the away end. Chief Superintendent Wayne Jones said his officers faced shocking levels of hostility. I mean, it's just depressing.
There is a sense of almost slipping back into the past, isn't there, though? You had this, the wrecking toilets behaviour immediately after the banana throwing incident in the North London Derby. And I just felt that, Herman Ouseley got that right. That is not behaviour in the 1970s. That is a reflection of who we are and the divided, bitter society that we've become for all manner of social and cultural and political reasons. And we have got to get a grip on this. But the difficulty is that there will always be these small pockets of malevolence. And when you've got something like the Checker Trade Trophy, for goodness sake, 8,000 people, that's probably more than there's been at the entire 312 matches they've been there so far. It's just a little, it's a big local difficulty, really. And we probably need to look at it in that sense. But I think it's a warning about the bigger picture. If we become a more divided society, where will we end up? And we might end up going back to the 70s.
A depressing way to end part two. And we'll start
sorry.
With quite a depressing
way. We won't have to wear like kipper ties and have really bad haircuts, will we?
I know. You'd have your Harrington and your bother boots on, mate.
Is that bell-bottom era? Is that that's what we'd be in? Or was that the 60s?
No, we'd be in two-tone. We'd be smart two-tone,
okay.
Yeah.
And we're all on mopeds, are we?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, some things to look forward to. Anyway, we'll start part three with whatever that DJ was thinking at the Ballon d'Or.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Ballon d'Or. So Luka Modric wins the men's award, breaking the hegemony of Messi and Ronaldo. Messi was fifth. Kylian Mbappe wins the Copa Trophy for under-21s. And Ada Hegerberg wins the women's award. The first time ever there's been a women's Ballon d'Or. Three-time winner of the Women's Champions League and the French League. She scored more than 250 career goals by the age of just 23. But that was not the news, Amy, was it? DJ Martin Solveig asking her if she knew how to twerk as she's handed the award. And I don't know how many people put their head in their hands. I don't know. I don't know. What was your immediate reaction to that?
What a prat. I think that the what I was probably most encouraged about was when it happened, the video edit goes straight, cut straight to Kylian Mbappe, who is a poster boy for youth, emerging, new generation, everything that's inspiring about young footballers, and he just looked as slightly ashamed and perplexed as most normal people would, and that was helpful. I just felt really sorry for her because. I've been around football, thankfully, for decades. And whenever someone goes, women in football, and starts to seek some sort of reaction or something from me, as if I'm some sort of, I interpret football or experience football differently from anybody else, it just depresses me because it's just like I don't really understand it. I don't think that your gender should be an influence on how you feel about football, how you enjoy it, how you play it, how you love it, how you watch it, how you interpret it. I just don't understand it really, and I never really have.
But you've worked in it for so long. I just wonder if you know this happens and it's a sign that it's still entrenched, right? In the game, or
I don't agree with that. I think it's just one bloke being a bit of an idiot, really, and it was just very, very unfortunate that he did it in a moment that should have been a quite uplifting one. Women's football is—it's still in its emerging phase in many ways. It's developing all the time, and when I think back to when I first started, women's football was such an afterthought. It was the idea that there would be a Ballon d'Or for women's football and that somebody would be on a stage next to the best men's player in the world was nonsensical. It just, you couldn't imagine that something like that was worth it even considering for more than half a second. I remember when I started out doing this job, being invited because I was a woman in football and there weren't many of us, only on the fringes, to commentate on the Women's World Cup final. It must have been sometime in the mid-1990s, and I was just a young reporter. And I didn't really know anything about women's football. I didn't watch it. I watched the men's game like anyone else in my job at that time. That's what I knew about. And I thought, well, I said to them, look, I don't really, you know, I don't know who anybody is. I don't know who's good. It wasn't really available to watch very much. There wasn't a great deal about it on any media channels. So they said, come and give it a go, it'll be all right. And it took place in their Eurosport studios in Paris. And I turned up and there was myself and Angus Loughran, known to some of you as Stato, in basically a cupboard. It was quite an alarming experience, with a monitor that was about the size of a sort of, you know, quite large a mobile phone, which had a feed of this Women's World Cup final match. And Stato and I had no team sheet. And it was really one of those moments where I thought, I'm so out of my depth here, you know. I don't know how to get through this 90 minutes. And the only upshot was that, you know, nobody would have been watching and listening, so more or less. So from that point, within 20 years, you were at a situation where a fine footballer is being honoured with a great award, and most people don't think it's a big deal that you've got a Women's Footballer of the Year award next to the men's equivalent, which in itself is a fantastic sign of progress. And it's just a great shame that one person sort of demeaned it.
Yeah, don't you think it's actually you know, more egregious simply because, you know, the whole sort of jerk and the twerk. Well, as you say, as you talked about, the stats of her career are fantastic. You know, her influence as a role model within women's football is great. And, you know, hopefully she'll go back on her intention not to play in next year's World Cup because there have been internal issues. But in the bigger picture, women's football is still... I read a really good piece by Anna Kessel where she talked about the women's game being underfinanced and underappreciated. And we're at a stage where the story is coming out now. You know, Susie Rack has done stuff in The Guardian about the Afghanistan story and the abuse that's gone on there. There was one of the leaks recently basically said that most women's Super League clubs don't pay sickness pay after 3 months. So, the, you know, there is this potential of professionalism, but there isn't the sort of infrastructure to support a professional game. So I think it, in a way it was really sad because that was the moment of recognition and credibility, and it was undermined. And I think there's also another broader point. I don't know what you guys think, and is that you look at modern ceremonies now, modern award ceremonies, with the exception of the Football Supporters Federation, of course, but they are awful. You know, the draws are bad theatre, bad panto.
The comment he made was some lame attempt at a gag involving some
What's he doing there in a football environment?
I don't know, but, you know.
Well, I'm playing the electro house tent at Glastonbury. I mean, it's madness, isn't it? I mean, from a professional point of view, I was sitting there thinking, you're hosting this event, right? They've chosen you to host it. You look at the running order, right? You get there early.
Because I haven't seen this. I've just seen one little clip because we were at a different awards ceremony. But wasn't David Ginola the host? And this guy was some sort of gormless sidekick, holds up mirror to self.
Yeah. but even still, right, you're there. You're part of the you'll have a meeting about the show, right? You'll look at the running order. You look at how it's organised. And you'll just go, somebody there must go, you know, here's a good chance to be funny or not, or try and be funny or don't be funny. Here's a bit you play straight. You know, you at these events, you know, you might have, these are sad things that have happened this season, these are good things that happened this season, whatever. For the first ever women's Ballon d'Or, you just think for that moment, you know, what's the benefit for me to, and things happen off the cuff, the fun, what is the benefit about trying something here, and why don't I just play this totally straight from a pro? I mean, and that is why you shouldn't have a superstar DJ doing it. You should have somebody who broadcasts for a living doing it, in my personal opinion. I'm not asking for the job. I'm just saying that you would avoid that issue then, I think.
But any time FIFA or UEFA or, you know, try to do funny, it never works. It always falls flat on its arse.
You know, there is this kind of almost idea that you have to make things sort of funny or quirky or what have you. And what's interesting is that, you know, the recipient of said award, you know, not everybody, just because you're good at football, it doesn't mean that you're a raconteur or that you're amusing or that you're, you know, clever enough or even have the confidence or the desire to do stuff other than basically go up and say thank you very much, like, you know. And I certainly can see why, particularly when you're a woman in a man's world, so to speak, not everybody wants to bang a drum about it. Sometimes you just want to get on with it and just do the best that you can. And it's not your thing to be put in a position where you're being expected to, you know, have some showmanship about it. That's probably not her personality, and it certainly looked that way with the disdain which she thought, like, oh, you know, do me a favour.
She actually made a very good speech,
it was brilliant
speech,
the way
wasn't
she,
it?
Yeah, and the way she dealt with it, you know, just by saying no and clearing off. Like, it's quite, sometimes when you're in a spotlight, you flounder and you try to do something that
accepting
is not natural.
Awards, it can be quite stressful. But I find the more you accumulate, the easier it gets. So hopefully in a few more years, Ada will be, you know, even better able to cope with such situations,
so
should they arise.
You won't look like a grinning cat just ready to do your Riverdance impression.
There is a photo where Jimbo's interviewing me and you are just literally giddy with glee at the whole sight of it, Barry. Anyway, it's not about you. Britain's gambling companies have voluntarily agreed to a whistle-to-whistle television advertising ban. The Remote Gambling Association, that includes, amongst others, Bet365, Ladbrokes, Paddy Power, has struck a deal to stop adverts during live sports broadcasts. Barry, I know you bang the drum for this a lot. It seems like a good idea, doesn't it?
It does seem like a great idea. It's not good news for Ray Winston and his big disembodied head, but my immediate impression when I saw this was, what's the catch? There's got to be a catch. Bookies don't do things like that unless there's something in it for them.
They still can do it in horse racing.
Yeah. Horse racing is kind of wholly reliant on bookmakers to stay going. So that's understandable. But it's great.
This is from Jack. Says, can you please preview the MLS? Sorry, not the MLS, just MLS Cup final. Saturday night, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. Atlanta United versus Portland Timbers. Good luck to Liam Ridgewell.
Is he still there?
He's still there. He's going for his second one. Also sells a range of swimming shorts.
Good for him.
For the second time in MLS history, back-to-back MVPs will face each other, Barry. The first time both players are playing for the teams they won the award for. This is after Atlanta United star Joseph Martinez won the Landon Donovan MLS MVP for this season. He will face up against Portland Timbers' Diego Valeri, who won it last year. Did anyone see the dog on the pitch in Argentina?
Fantastic.
Isn't it? Absolutely brilliant. This was during a third tier game between Juventud Unida de... Oh, God. Gualeguaychú and Defensores de Belgrano de Villarramal. The home side were already three up and they had another chance. A keeper came out, punched it away. Striker slotted it home and a dog ran along and saved it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that a dog could manage to get in the way of that.
Bruce Dogalar.
Anyone else? Any with better than that?
No.
Did anyone see the clip of Lucas Torreira's father celebrating his goal?
No.
He's in a butcher's shop in Fray Bentos. I mean, just dig it out. It's glorious.
Is he the butcher?
Well, what's brilliant about it is there's a telly attached to the shop front, and he's behind the counter of the butcher shop. There's loads of meat on display, and
he hasn't got machete in his hand, has he?
And a bloodied apron.
No, but at one point, I'm sure it sounds like the till going, just sort of mid sort of celebration of the goal.
But as his son is scoring, he's celebrating. He can still sell half a kilo of mince.
I don't. Just check it out. I'm not sure if it's a till, but it's a really, really wonderful moment. It tells you a lot about where he's come from to get to where he is.
Here's a nice story from Germany. Stefan Kiesling, who spent 12 years at Bayer Leverkusen, scored 131 goals in 342 games, has announced he got his wife to do pre-season for him, where they were given heart rate monitors. He said, as my wife is very athletic, she did some racing with the wristband according to my specs. So he'd say, look, this is how fast I need you to run. He said, I was on a lake in Mexico. I just stayed on the beach. This is how fast I want to do it. He said, didn't bother. As a player, I was still fine. So good for him. Feedback corner time. Thanks to the 3,000 of you who noticed that I got Percy Pigs and Peppa Pigs mixed up. Sam, Percy Pigs, not Peppa Pigs. Another nail in the coffin of the Rushton broadcasting career. Hashtag not my Jimbo. Alistair pointed out that when we were discussing Euro 2020, we completely forgot Scotland's qualifying group. So apologies to you. Belgium, who are ranked one in the world. I didn't know that. Russia, Cyprus, Kazakhstan and San Marino. So, you know, they've got a chance there, Baz, haven't they?
My concern about Scotland is now that they've nailed down this sort of playoff thing in Division 3 of the
Nations League.
League, that they'll won't bother with the... They'll use it as a safety net and won't bother with the group qualification.
Here's a question from Tonksarama, who says, watching John Carew starring in the excellent Norwegian TV drama Home Ground, has there ever been a finer football thespian? I would draw everyone to Frank LeBeouf in the Stephen Hawking film, where
an hour and 20 into the movie, he just appears as a surgeon.
I know.
And half the cinema just watch it because they just think it's a French actor. And the others, like you and I, Amy, are like, what the hell is Frank LeBeau doing there?
I was so stunned by that. I remember being totally into this film, and it was set like a world's colliding moment. Mm.
I mean, he did a perfectly good job, but it just didn't work because it was Frank LeBeuf, right? Mm. It's our fault for liking football, really. And Matty says, who do you think would win in a race of... It's after Klopp running on the pitch. Who would win in a race of all the Premier League managers from the touchline to the opposite end in a kind of Rumbelows sprint challenge? That's a good question.
Can we handicap this? It's a bit unfair on sort of Roy Hodgson and things, isn't it?
Are you going to say we strap some weights to Marco Silva? Is that... no, I think it's got to be all's fair in an easy 100-metre sprint. Barry, have you just suddenly forgotten all the managers in the Premier League? that's where I'm at. Who do you think?
Who do you think?
I mean, Klopp and Jose have form, right?
Yeah. I'm trying to think who's the fittest, but like you say, I cannot remember who manages any of the clubs in the Premier League now that you've put me on the
spot. If Michael Appleton was still there, I mean, he was a fit lad,
but
wasn't he?
But
carrying a lot of muscle. Producer Jonathan says, surely Pochettino or Guardiola. I mean, they're both in decent nick, but I don't think they're not dressed appropriately, are they? So yeah, David Wagner's dressed in more sort of running gear. Mm. Pochettino's now in that sort of very suave black suit, and Pep wouldn't want to. Is in jeans and a sweatshirt. Anyway, that's a nice way to finish the pod, isn't it? And that's why
you've done better.
That's why next year we won't win the Football Supporters Federation Pod of the Year. Hey, thanks for coming, Mike.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.